You're listening to episode 7 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order. This episode is going to be largely, I think, listener feedback driven, meaning that I will be reviewing a bunch of listener feedback that I've gotten over the past couple of weeks. The usual disclaimers apply. If I forget to mention your email on this show, it doesn't mean that it's because I didn't deem it worthy or because I don't care about you personally. It's just that I'm not very organized when it comes to listener feedback still. But I'm getting better, and I think that'll be reflected here because I'm going to catch a lot of them. And either way, as usual, if I don't read it out loud on the show or if I don't address it on the show, I have almost always certainly emailed you back in person via email, so as you can see, I clearly do care about you, just not so much that I remember to mention you on air. No, actually, I do care about you a lot, but I still might not remember to mention your email. Or yours might be covered by some other answer to some other email, so it's just a matter of choosing whose email to read. It's a flip of a coin, I promise, it's nothing personal. So, with all those disclaimers released out there, let's get started. Just go ahead and tackle all the bash tip stuff that I've gotten, and there's quite a bit. So first, there's feedback on some of the bash tips that I posted. So what I was doing for a while was going through and manually changing special characters like carrots and brackets and curly brackets and quotes and single quotes and all these other things, slashes, backslashes, into HTML-friendly characters. So instead of having literally a forward slash, for instance, or is that a backslash, whatever that is, where it slashes from the bottom left to the upper right, instead of having that, I would have ampersand hash 47 semicolon. Or instead of a quote, ampersand hash 34 semicolon. So I was doing that just by hand and then pasting it into the HTML as show notes. And that seemed like an okay idea, except when it didn't work. And it wasn't working especially on Remy's lstree function. So what I have done now is just I took that whole block of HTML code and ditched it and pasted the plain text into a plain text document that I linked to from the main page of GNUWorldOrder.info. So now you can literally just copy and paste that code from the plain text page into your .bashrc, source your .bashrc, and suddenly you've got lstree again. As we've discovered, I think since then, I think it was lstree, there's a function called either tree or lstree that you could install on your distribution, so you might have to do some name changing of your little function or whatever. Point is, it exists now, it is not munged at all, it's just plain text, like it should have been in the first place, really. Now, one of the cool things that sort of came from that being a problem was that a guy named Charles wrote me, and Charles, actually a few people named Charles wrote me, but this particular Charles is a PHP programmer, and he was feeling my need for something that would convert the very peculiar kind of bash code, all that bash scripting stuff, into something that HTML would not try to then, I don't know, execute or interpret as a tag or something like that. He actually wrote a command line PHP application that will convert all the characters for you. So if you're pasting in code into your blog or into a page that you're coding, HTML coding, you could pass it through this PHP script, and it will convert those characters. You can paste the new stuff in there, and it'll translate nicely without the very human ability or likelihood that you will mistype or forget to do a non-breaking white space when you need one or whatever you forget to do. So it's very cool. I will link to the code. Well, I'll paste his code somewhere, and I'll also probably link. No, I'll just paste it. I'll paste it somewhere. It will be on GNU World Order. Trust me. I will link to it. It's very neat. Try it out. And that's a gift to the community from Charles Simonton. So thank you, Charles, very much for that. I cannot wait to use it. I'm going to use it on this very episode, in fact. Now, the next one's kind of cool. This email I got from another Charles. As I said, I got a couple of Charleses. This one's from Charles somebody. Don't know if I'm really supposed to say last names. So this Charles is like a mathematician, which, okay, that's interesting. That's cool. Computer people are often mathematicians. Mathematicians fascinate me because math fascinates me. I'm no good at it, but it's always an interesting read. So this guy was saying, basically, thank you for Slacker Media, which is, of course, the little book project that I maintain on how to set up Slackware for multimedia purposes. You may have heard me mention it before. And, in fact, Lost in Bronx himself runs Slacker Media, at least for now. So, a lot of, I guess I should take, you know, I should use this as an advertising opportunity. A lot of the Lost in Bronx productions that you have heard over the past year or so, it was all made on Slacker Media. So once I get a little jingle for Slacker Media, that would be inserted there. But for now, yes, Slacker Media, it exists. Charles, this other Charles, is saying thank you for it, which was interesting. And I kind of was reading it, and I was curious as to why a mathematician cared about Slacker Media. Turns out it's not so much Slacker Media that he's interested in as the idea of kind of self-built, self-designed distributions based largely around Slack builds, which really is what Slacker Media is. Originally, when I started Slacker Media, when I did Slacker Media, it was very, very much based around, two things, SBO, PKG, and compiling from source, which compiling from source is generally done better and more efficiently with Slack builds. So the concept of being able to take a very robust install of a Linux distribution like Slackware. Slackware, I mean, if you've never tried it, it's got everything you need. It's not a small OS. It's not a minimal operating system. It's a 4-gig DVD that you get, and after you uncompress everything, it's about like 8 gigs or so of stuff on your computer. So it's not one of those, hey, look, you can get a system installed, 700 megabytes ends up as maybe 2 gigs of actual disk space being used. You know, it's a big thing. It's got a lot of stuff, and it kind of assumes that you're doing a full install. And that's a good thing in some cases, right? Because then you know exactly what's on your system. You've got a lot on your system. You've got all the kernel headers. You've got all the header files. You know, there's not development packages versus normal packages. It's all there. So building on top of that is quite easy because, first of all, you've got a tool for practically everything you could possibly want to do anyway. And then in the event that you don't, like for specialized things like multimedia or apparently math, then you've got a lot to build upon. You know, when you go to install your digital audio workstation or your video editor or whatever mathematicians use, you don't need to go and install a bunch of development libraries and kernel headers and things like that so that you can then build these new tools. You've already got that sort of foundation existing on your system. And he was talking very specifically about being able to distribute and redistribute and share new algorithms within his mathematical department, wherever he works or does his math, via Slack builds. And it would be, I think, remarkably easy to do that, and I think he's saying so as well. You can do that. You could make a Slack build quite easily for these things. I think, and I'm going to talk about this even more in response to yet another email kind of on a similar subject, but I want to go ahead and start mentioning it now. Slack builds are really, really easy to create. If you can compile software, then you can make a Slack build. And it's just, it's really that simple. It's not one of those things where, yeah, I know how to compile software, but I haven't looked into the intricacies of how to, the syntax and the macros involved in building an RPM or a .deb. If you can compile software, you can basically make a Slack build, because all you're doing is automating the thing that you are already doing. There, now that slackbuilds.org exists, which, I mean, in my Linux life, it's pretty much always existed. I don't remember a time when it wasn't around, so there's that. But now that it does exist, they've got a template. In fact, they've got a whole Git repository of about 5 or 6 different templates of every build. For every build process that you could kind of imagine, there's like make, or auto tools, I guess is what it would be called. There's one for CMake, there's a Python, a Ruby, a Perl. They're all there. You can go in, it's shell scripting, so if you can use a Linux terminal, which presumably you've been using if you're compiling software, then you can make this, you can understand this shell script. And the cool thing about it is that everything you do within this, from executing this shell script that you've just made, it's automated, it tracks everything that you've just installed. It's really cool. It's an RPM, essentially, without the overhead of knowing RPM macros and the structure of RPMs and stuff like that, and having to have an RPM build environment, all these different things, and deb, too. I can't remember if I've actually ever made a deb, but it's very nice. Very, very slick, Slack builds are. And in my mind, Slack builds and then BSD ports and then RPM. And again, I don't think I've ever made a deb. If I did, it was just for fun, and it's not something that I could easily replicate. But sort of that's the order of, I guess, simplicity. And by simplicity, I mean barrier of entry. And I don't mean to slander BSD ports or RPM and say Slack builds is the only way to do it, and why would anyone look at anything else? RPMs and ports and debs are all very cool, and they do a lot of neat things. But in terms of, like, me being able to sit down and figure something out, it was Slack builds that made that possible. And it wasn't for lack of trying. I looked at other things before I really latched on to Slack builds as the thing. But just in my own experience, sitting in my apartment trying to figure this out from really not knowing a whole lot, it was Slack builds that was the easiest hurdle to overcome. So what I'm trying to say is that barrier of entry is lower for Slack builds, in my humble opinion. And that's kind of one of the beauties, I think, of Slackware and the Slack build system that enabled me to create this thing called Slacker Media, and could enable Charles to make Slacker Math, or whatever he ends up with. So it's neat. It's really cool, I think. I guess I'm trying to say that there's this distribution that really lends itself well to modularly building a new distribution off of it or on top of it. And it's not, of course, a new distribution. It is, as I've said, a distribution from text, basically. It's just like, hey, install this thing and now plug in some other stuff, and now you've got this new thing that you could call Slacker Math or Slacker Media or Slack whatever. And I think that's a great way of doing things. And it kind of feels very Slacks as well, the SLAX Slacks thing, where they do that literally just with little modules that you plug in, and you end up with like this kind of customized distribution. I like that. I like that more than respins or remixes or whatever we're calling Ubuntu and Fedora modifications, distros of the week. I like it better that each user could have their own set of modules and plugins that they can then put into their distribution and have something customized and different and unique. I think I've gotten my point across now. Let's move on. Okay, so there is another Slackware-related feedback, but it's a big one, and I don't want to go straight from having just rambled about Slackware and Slacker Media and Slacker Math to more Slackware stuff. So I'll take a break from all that and mention this email from Ron, a friend who keeps sending me links like you wouldn't believe, like links every day, multiple times a day. And it's great because there's some good stuff in there. There's some stuff I don't care about, but there's always something interesting one way or the other. And this one, I think, deserves a little bit of a mention. It's a GNU Linux tablet, as reported on an Italian website, a news website. I don't really understand Italian all that well. Kind of reading it, knowing the context, you can kind of figure out what they're saying. Anche il mondo dei tablet sta per avere il suo lato open source lontano da battagli legali sui brevetti e restrizioni sulle modifiche al software. L'azienda statunitense PengPod è riuscita a trovare abbastanza fondi per lanciare a gennaio due tavolette con sistema operativo Linux. Which basically is saying that there's a new tablet with the operating system Linux on it, and that Linux is this open source thing that has no restrictions and that you can modify your software. At least that's what I'm kind of gathering from it. Let me know if you differ. They also mentioned the brand name, or the name of the tablet, which apparently is going to be the PengPod, PengPod. Strangely, the news story didn't even have a link to anything, so I had to kind of search around for it, but I found it pretty quickly. It seems to be a project on Indiegogo, which is a Kickstarter-like website that probably has some different allotment of who gets the money from whom, and it does seem to be the case that someone is taking probably a tablet, I imagine, from China, generic tablet, and they're loading it with pure Linux, although they do actually offer the option to load it up with Android. But the point is, of course, that you won't have to root it. It's going to be something that you can mess around with. And I guess, ideally, they'll be doing a Linux install, something that simply has Linux on it. This, I guess, is cool. I mean, I have zero interest in tablets, so it's hard for me to really get all that excited about it. Tablets, to me, are just phenomenally useless devices. They're larger than a Nokia N800, so they don't fit in a pocket at all. They don't have a keyboard, so you can't type on them. So they're just kind of oversized internet tablets that really just, it seems to me, they get in the way. They suck up battery, so it's not like it could even be a really great ebook reader, because at least the ebook readers, like with e-ink, I mean, at least those have batteries that last for 2 and 3 weeks at a time. That seems okay. I could look into that. But in terms of, like, just a computing platform that you carry around, give me a keyboard or don't give me the thing at all. So really, no interest in tablets at all. Not interested right now. I might be in the future. That might be a form factor that I need later on. It might be something that I'll look at once they really get down the whole keyboard interaction thing. And certainly having Linux on the tablet would make me much more excited about the tablet, because, I mean, absolutely no interest in Android or the other competing software on tablets. Well, software is now, I guess technically there's more than one, but no interest in that, because, I mean, I don't want to have to go in this roundabout way to get Emacs loaded onto my device so that I can actually get work done. That is, I can actually type. I don't want to deal with that. I want to be able to have access to all of the things that I have access to on a normal Linux system, because otherwise it's not a computer replacement. It's this useless toy that you can either load the software that you want onto or even type into. So what good is it? Not very for me. So this is a step in the right direction for sure. Not enough to prompt me to purchase it, mainly because right now I don't need anything like this. But if this is truly where the computer world is headed, I hope it isn't, but if it is, then I guess this would be the direction I would go into, for sure. I would not want to run Android. I would not want to run anything else. I would want to run Linux, because that's where the productivity is. And while Android might be very pretty and it might have a lot of apps, it's just, they're not, they're not serious about getting computing done, at least in my mind. A lot of these touch applications that I've seen so far have been all about doing exactly what the app wants you to do. You know, I mean, they're not that flexible. And that, to me, is very dangerous because it kind of makes the computer user a lot dumber. It makes you even not literally dumber. It doesn't actually steal your IQ. Or maybe it does. I don't know. But I mean, it dumbs down your interactions with the device. So rather than being able to multitask and pull widgets from one place to another and use menus and text entry, you get like five big icons and you can click on each different one and they might do some different thing. And that's it. That's the extent of what you can do. It's not like you can actually think and be inventive and come up with new exciting ways to design some different idea that you have. You just have to fit your idea into what that application can do. The fact that people are actually settling for this is astonishing to me. And I don't know how artists are taking this seriously at all. I'm shocked. And I know a couple of artists who are swearing by their tablet devices right now. And it's just like, wow, you can play your guitar into this tablet and record. That's really cool. And wow, you have three different reverbs that you can choose from. But what if none of those reverbs really suit you? What if you want to go in and tweak it and make it different? What do you do then? I mean, it's astonishing to me that people can sit down in front of Audacity and have the audacity to say, oh, well, this isn't flexible enough for me. This isn't a real DAW. You can't do this. You can't do that. And then the same person will go and sit in front of a tablet branded by a company that does marketing really thoroughly, and they'll be like, oh, this is the most amazing thing. I could never make my music without this tablet because, look, I have this prefabricated reverb unit that I can apply to my music. You're just like, yeah. And in Audacity, you've got like three different reverb units with actual controls that you can modify and so on. I mean, this is just an example, but the point is that it's astonishing to me that people are settling for a dumbed down platform, and then they sit in front of something else and say, well, this GIMP isn't good enough for me because I'm a real pro and I need, you know, all these other functions. And then they'll go to their tablet and apply a Instagram filter to their photograph, and that's okay somehow. Really, really strange. Really dangerous, I think, because it takes the production out of the computer user. You know, they just want you to be a consumer so bad, and they're like, well, let's not give them too many choices, because then they're making stuff, they're generating content, they're not consuming, they're actually doing stuff. Let's take that away from them and hand them a tablet that they can't even type into. It's a dangerous trend, you mark my words. You heard it here first. All right, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking it's time for a coffee break. Well, it's not yet, so don't get too excited. It's almost time for a coffee break. Before we go to a coffee break, we will talk about this other email I got from AG. I don't know who this is. Cool little site, though. AG runs bkaeg.org. That's bkaeg.org. He's got a blog over there. I don't know if I know this guy or if I met him, maybe. On his blog, he mentions OLF, so I might have actually met this guy in person. But whoever he is, he's got a cool blog, so go check that out. But specifically, he's responding, and yes, I'm stealing feedback from Hacker Public Radio again. He's responding to my Hacker Public Radio episode on Samba shares. And I did a Hacker Public Radio episode on Samba because, well, I've got this little networking mini-series going on over at HPR. But also it's just something that I've been dealing with lately, and that is setting up different kinds of file shares. And knowing how to do that is a pretty powerful thing for a Linux advocate and or admin, because it gives you the ability to work within a predefined system but still get to use the operating system of your choice. So if you walk into a building and they're running one operating system and you've been tasked to create a file share or a system of some sort that will talk to those computers and vice versa in a user-friendly manner, then knowing a little bit about Samba and even other solutions is, you know, it can be important, and it can get a Linux server up and running in that organization where maybe there was no Linux server before, but it's completely compatible, and that's kind of nice, and it's a powerful thing. And in theory, I guess, this hasn't exactly panned out for me, not exactly, but I mean, in theory, if you've got a Linux server going, then and the sum total of that Linux server was, you know, the cost of the physical box and maybe some kind of Red Hat support contract if you want to go that route, or nothing if you want to go that route. They look at that versus the price of some other operating system. In theory, that could sway them in one direction. Although, inexplicably, I think sometimes it doesn't, because somehow, even though they're all about the money, and then they see something that just got into their server room for a lot cheaper, that doesn't really talk to them in the same language. I don't know why. I don't know the breach of logic there. Anyway, Samba, important. The thing about Samba is that there are, well, any file share, is that if you've got groups of people working on a file share, that they're essentially using each other's files, right? So the question arises, well, how does the permission get applied to these files that are being created by one user, being changed by another and saved back, and then another file is being added to that mix from all different places, right? So there's a set GID, which is set group ID, and this will solve a lot of problems when you're creating directories that other people are then going to use. In other words, you need the same users to always have access to a directory or a file or whatever without any kind of interruption. User A shouldn't have to be there to set permissions for user B when user B comes into the office and needs to look at last quarter's budget or whatever people in offices look at. So you can do this with a find command, of course. You can do everything with a find command. So you can do a find /path/2/directory /--d for directory /exec/chmod /g+s /:\, to complete the exec command. What that does is finds all the directories in your Samba share. That would be the path to the directory of your Samba share, and it's locking in the group to whom that directory exists. So if I've got a group called finances or something, finance, and they've got a folder that all members of the finance group should have access to, then setting this group ID locks that in, so that the next time someone opens that directory and does some stuff in it, the permission of that directory does not get changed to their already default group on their computer, like users or something like that. So that would be essential if you're managing shares, because it happens. You know, someone will open up a directory on their local computer and the permission gets overridden by their local group settings. It's not what you want. You want all of the group settings and ownership to stay as you've designed them, rather than being changed by whoever happens to touch the directory last. And actually, seeing the signature on this email, I see that this is from Sons of Man, who actually I do kind of know. Don't know if I could pick him out in a crowd off the top of my head, but yeah, I know Sons of Man. So thank you, Sons of Man, for that tip. Okay, now it's time for a coffee break, so go get yourself a cup. Come back and we'll talk about more cool bash tricks. We'll talk about dependency resolution and a couple of other listener feedback topics. What are you still sitting there listening for? Go get your coffee. Okay, I can see that you've got your coffee in hand. That's great. So let's talk a little bit about some of the bash tricks and tips and things that I got over the course of the past couple of weeks. This one's from Dave Morris, who I know roughly from Hacker Public Radio. So this one is called stamp file, and this renames a file by adding a timestamp to its name. The timestamp is the modification time. It is added at the end by default or wherever the caller places the character's %s. Note that there are not enough error checks to deal with really weird requests. So this is not possibly for everything, but it could work usually. So it's function stamp file, paren paren, curly bracket, if bracket bracket dollar sign number equals zero, pipe pipe dollar sign hash, redirect to, close bracket, then echo usage func name file name template return, end or close the if statement. So that, in the abbreviated form that I've just read it, checks to make sure that you've got something in your as an argument. In other words, if the user just types in stamp file, then it will return stamp file file name template. So it's giving you a little help message, essentially. That's what it's doing. I think those little checks are important to remember in shell scripts, because listen to me talking like I know what I'm talking about, but really, in my experience with my shell scripts, I've noticed that it's really great that if you just enter the command without giving anything else, it doesn't just return zero, it doesn't just give you a stupid error message, it provides feedback, useful feedback, like, hey, you're supposed to type this thing in and then give me a file name so that I know what to do. So that's always good, I think. Anyway, then it continues and says, okay, local fname equals dollar sign curly bracket 1 curly bracket. So that's establishing a local variable within that function so that, you know, it doesn't become some kind of, I guess, public variable, I guess is what it's called, or shared variable. I don't know. I think it's public. It's just within that function. So once that function runs, that variable goes away. So locally, the fname equals whatever you've given the function. So if I've typed in stamp file foo, then fname becomes foo. Local tp equals dollar sign curly bracket 2 colon dash quote dollar sign curly bracket fname curly bracket underscore %s dollar sign curly bracket. What this does is establishes a local variable called tp, and it establishes it as whatever your second argument was, with the default being the file name fname underscore %s. This is another cool trick, because here we get the variable of tp, we define it by default as whatever we want it to be, but we give it the option to default to whatever the second argument was. And that's nice, because you get a sane default for this command. Next block of code here is bracket dash e quote dollar sign fname dollar sign bracket pipe pipe curly bracket echo quote fname does not exist quote semicolon return semicolon curly bracket. So again, it's just checking to make sure that the file that you've just given it, the file name that you've just given it, actually does exist. And that's important, obviously. And then new equals dollar sign paren printf space dollar sign, or quote rather, dollar sign tp quote space dollar sign paren date space dash r space dollar sign rather quote dollar sign fname quote space plus %y %m %d blah 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 close bracket or close paren. So what that one is doing is creating a new file, or a new variable rather, called new, and it's putting into that variable the results of a printf statement, which takes the temporary file name and sticks the date onto it, and then we move mv quote dollar sign fname to quote dollar sign new So there we're just replacing the old file name that we gave it when we typed the command stamp file foo. It's now replacing foo with foo underscore a bunch of date stuff. Or pipe pipe echo quote unable to move fname to new. So again, there's error checking there. If it fails to move the new file to the old, you know, the old file to the new file name, then it gives you an error. And that's the end of the function. So it's a really nice little function as far as I can tell. I mean, it seems to do a lot of error checking. It really tries to be graceful in how it fails when it does fail. So it's kind of neat. You should check it out. I will utilize Charles's PHP script to HTMLize that and post it online for you. And you can give that a shot. Now, interestingly, and I hate doing this, deflating, you know, things that people sent me, but we actually did just learn in a couple of episodes ago about a cool little trick that really kind of does this already. And it was called, let me see if I can find it, MakeTemp, MKTMP. And this is, I don't know if it's how built in it is or what, but MakeTemp is a tool from OpenBSD. It's default on Slackware anyway. And it takes the, you know, whatever file name you give it, plus a template if you're giving it one, and it overwrites a portion of it to create a unique file name. So it's guaranteed, or more or less, to always be unique. You can kind of give it parameters in a template argument. So it essentially does the same thing. But if you don't have that command on your system, then this one from Dave Morris, could be really helpful to you. Or if you actually do, for some reason, want it to be less temporary and more date-oriented, then this might also be helpful. So there you go. Okay, so now I'm going to delve a little bit into Slackware stuff again, and then we'll round off the episode with a couple of random feedbacks, and then that'll be the show. So this discussion is kind of interesting, and it came to me from Sig3, is the guy's either name or internet name, I don't really know. Anyway, he's from Norway, so it could be anything. But yeah, Sig3 emailed me, and he had some really interesting points. And he's not the only one who mentioned this to me. Someone else mentioned, K5 Tux actually mentioned this to me in IRC. K5 Tux from Linux and the Ham Shack. So I think it's worth discussing a little bit, because it kind of brought up some good points, both from Sig3 and, I humbly submit, from myself. So in episode X805, I was talking about sport, and I was talking about how I did not like automatic dependency resolution. This got a couple of people talking about that concept. One thing I started to notice pretty quickly, actually, as I wrote my response, because I was doing it myself, but I realized that the two different topics are getting combined accidentally. There's dependency resolution, and then there's compiling from source. They are not really as related as you might think, right? Now, it just so happens that in the context of which I was speaking about it, I was talking about compiling from source, because I like to compile from source. That's just me. But if you're saying you don't do automatic dependency resolution, that does not mean you are compiling from source necessarily. You could be installing things from packages and still be resolving your own dependencies. And you might think, well, that's a theoretical thing. Well, no, it's not. Like, if you go and install a new KDE update from Alien Bob's personal Slack package repository, you are not compiling that from source. You are simply installing a group of Slackware packages from a server, but you are not having a command that goes out and finds all your dependencies and resolves them for you. You're resolving them yourself. So it's important to differentiate in our minds, I think, that when I'm saying I do not like dependency resolution, I'm saying I don't like dependency resolution, and saying, well, it's stupid to compile source code all the time on a slow machine, that those are two different statements, or two different, I hesitate to use the word arguments because that makes it confrontational, so, but those are two different topics, right? And it just so happens that when I personally am talking about resolving dependencies, I often am talking about compiling source code. But that doesn't mean that I'm always talking about compiling source code. And it certainly doesn't mean that resolving your own dependencies means that you have to compile from source code. I've just given you an example where it doesn't. And I've got even more examples than that. So, taking them one sort of by one. Dependency resolution. I don't see it as a repetitive task, because I only install software every so often. So for me personally, to resolve my own dependencies, that's not something that I see as a waste of time. I actually see it as a very informative process, and something where I get to now control myself rather than assigning to a computer to just kind of make it all work when it does work. And I guess I don't have complete faith in computers such that I believe it will always work, especially to get exactly what I want. Getting ahead of myself a little bit. But the point being that dependency resolution does not have to be repetitive. Now you might think, well, it does get repetitive if you think of all Linux users as one user. You know, why should all you Linux users have to sit individually at home and resolve dependencies? You know, that's like a million people sitting there installing all these dependencies just so that they can install Kdenlive, for instance. That's because, you know, a million people are using Kdenlive, right? No, but like whatever, like I don't know what W3M. That's a great example because I kind of know it. So W3M requires at least two different libraries on Slackware. So if every Slackware user is having to install both of those dependencies just to get W3M installed, there is a sense of repetition there. And I see that point. I totally see that point. And having a computer automate that aspect of it does seem to make sense. And I could see why that would be appealing to people. I can see that. I mean, heck, I've benefited from it myself. I'm not speaking from a position of someone who's never had dependency resolution in their life. I don't know what that is. I'm just locked into my own Slackware universe. It's just I happen to prefer the Slackware way of not having something else resolve my dependencies. But yes, I have done a yum install on systems, and I have seen, I have witnessed the greatness of GC and libnet or whatever, download, install, and then W3M installing afterwards. I've seen this happen. And with W3M, I could sacrifice, you could force upon me the automatic dependency resolution, and I'd be fine with it, probably. I would probably be okay with that. With something that depends on, for instance, FFmpeg, that we'd have to talk, because that's something that I compile very specifically. Qtractor, I do very specific things. I have yet to find a dependency resolution system that gives me exactly what I want in the multimedia world, so there you go. Now, the advantage that I feel like I and other users could gain from resolving their own dependencies is that, number one, you kind of know what's going into your system. Now, you could find that out on any other system as well, right? On Fedora, if you want to know what's going into your computer when you're installing, when you're doing the yum install kdenlive, you can do the research. You can find out. It's not that hard. And I understand that. I'm not trying to say that there's no place in the world for systems that automatically resolve dependencies. And I'm not saying that they're impossible to use. Not by any means. I am saying that when I'm physically, as it were, installing all of these dependencies myself, I get an idea, I get a more clear idea personally for what exactly is involved in a package. Especially in the Linux world and maybe this is true for other systems, but I at least am very sensitive of it in the Linux world. You know, you get this package, you get this application that uses very modularly other things. And Kdenlive is a perfect example for me. Qtractor would probably do it as well, but Kdenlive I know pretty well in this case. So if you go and install, you want to install Kdenlive, and then you see, oh well, it depends on all these different codec packages, and it also may depend on FreeOR, and FFmpeg, and MLT. So now you're aware that there are components that are doing very important things within Kdenlive, such as FreeOR. Well, if you ever open up Kdenlive and you see that your compositing, your fancy compositing effect that you wanted isn't there, why isn't it there? Are you on the wrong version of Kdenlive? Have you installed it wrong? Or did you just forget to install FreeOR? If you know what FreeOR is, and if you've had to install it, and you've seen the message that says, hey, this is a bunch of filters for Kdenlive, this is a package of video filters, then you would know, right when you open up Kdenlive and the filters aren't there, you know that quickly that you're missing FreeOR and that you need to go install that and relaunch Kdenlive. And when you're in Kdenlive and you're moving media around and you're chopping it up and there's some kind of frame inconsistency, or it's performing really well and you're very happy and you want to know who to blame, you know that that's probably not really Kdenlive, that's MLT managing all that media. And Kdenlive is just your interface to that. And when you're exporting stuff or converting stuff, you're transcoding stuff so that you can bring it in, or you're exporting it, you're rendering it, and something fails, or something isn't working quite right, or you want to add a special flag that the Kdenlive default export options don't utilize, you know that all that's being done through FFmpeg, and so you can bring up the man page of FFmpeg, read up on the flags that you want to use, and utilize that. Okay, I'm getting way off track here, sorry. Point being that if you understand what goes into your software, like the different components, then you're able to use the software better, I think. And the way that I find myself being able to be more aware of what's going into these software packages is by resolving the dependencies myself. So, and again, this could just all be me, for all I know, and a couple of other Slackware users, but it is something that helps me kind of understand what's happening on the back end so that when I'm using the software, I have better chances of troubleshooting, or just better chances of understanding how to best get something done. That's dependency resolution. That's kind of my thoughts on that subject, as I emailed it back to SIG3. Now, another one came to me the other day as I was walking and kind of pondering this whole subject, and that is, I can't count on one hand or two hands how many times I have been trying to manage packages on a system, and I will go to remove a package that I no longer want, and it suddenly wants to remove a package that I don't want removed. Or I go and do an update of one thing, and it wants to update a bunch of other packages that I'm a little bit nervous about having those packages updated. Now, once again, the standard caveat to all of these quote-unquote complaints is that I know that there's a way around this. Like in Debian, you can do apt pinning, I think it is, and you can do like blacklisting, kind of tell the system to stop, you know, don't manage these packages for me. I want them to stay as they are. And that's really important to me on a multimedia system, because not to keep going back to Kdenlive, but if you were to, for instance, have a package manager manage Kdenlive for you, it could very well update Kdenlive to one point, you know, just a point little update, and it completely breaks compatibility with MLT, or it stops understanding the version of FFmpeg that you've got. Or I guess that would probably happen if it updated FFmpeg without updating Kdenlive, but those kinds of things can happen, and they've sort of happened to me before, and that's why on my production systems I don't update like that. I don't let package managers handle that. And what distribution could possibly be better for not having your package manager update stuff out from under you than a system without a package manager? as such. Yes, it has a package manager, but I'm just saying it doesn't have one of those automated updating kinds of package managers. That's really important to me, like seriously important. And I don't think, actually, I know that I'm not unique in that feeling because I'm just around too many multimedia people, and I just know that people running multimedia systems, even not free ones, I'm talking about proprietary ones, you just don't let your system update stuff on you. It's just too dangerous. I mean, if you're in the middle of a project and one morning you turn on your computer and it turns out, hey, it's updated, and you turn it on and you open up your multimedia application, whether it's KdenLive or QTract or whatever, or maybe it's your entire computer, maybe the kernel updated out from under you and something doesn't work. And that's a scary, scary, frustrating thing that I don't want to deal with on Linux. That's not what I want to do. That's why I'm on this system, because I don't have to put up with stuff like that. That's a refreshing, refreshing thing. Okay, I think someone was asking me about multiple systems, and I was saying that, you know, for me, I've got three different boxes that I manage, two of my own, one of a friend's, a Slacker media system. And I have to say, I mean, I really, like, right now in my in real life, all I have to do, like on my workstation, on my like 8-core i7 desktop computer running Slackware, I will put the queue of Slackware packages or Slack builds into SBOPKG or whatever. I will have them build one after the other, generate packages, and then I'll install all those packages with install PKG, and then I'll copy those packages to a hard drive and just walk them over to my laptop and go into that directory and install them all. Just like that. It's a really it's not a horrible process. It works out really well for me. And someone was saying, well, isn't that essentially automatic dependency resolution? The only difference is that you're doing the workload. And yeah, it kind of is, I guess, but the difference is that I get to do the workload. I get to decide what gets installed, what doesn't. I get to decide whether these optional dependencies are actually important or not. I get to decide how these certain applications that are very, very important to me are built and compiled, what options they get rolled into them. I just feel like I get a lot more control that way. And once again, caveat, I'm sure you can go in and change. I know you can go in and change an RPM and tell it, okay, I know you think you want Sound, Touch, and Tulane, but I don't. Or you don't think you do, but I want you to. You can do those things, and I understand that. I just think it happens to be a lot simpler, a lot more transparent on the Slack build, the Slackware side of things. Okay, so that was all about dependency resolution. Separate thing is source code, I think. And a lot of people have asked me about, why do you compile from source? Why are you doing this? This is silly. You don't have to do that. It's useless. There's a difference between knowing how to compile from source versus compiling from actually compiling from source, and so on. And yeah, I mean, right now, compiling from source is worth my time. I've got a powerful computer that can build for my less powerful computers. It really is just it's worth it to me to do that. Partly because I learn a lot. You know, when builds fail, I learn something new. And I like that. I value that because I feel like I've learned a lot that way. I've been compiling source from literally the first time I've used Linux, because I thought it was a cool thing. Like I discovered it on my old operating system and I thought, wow, this is really incredible that I can do this. I'm such a geek. And I just carried that over into Linux and I've not really stopped. I enjoy it, but I also enjoy, or I don't enjoy it when it fails, but you have to admit, when it does fail, you do learn new stuff. I mean, sometimes you don't learn anything and it's just frustrating. And honestly, a lot of times when that happens, I just go and find a package that someone has built and download and install that. VLC is actually a really good example. VLC, I can compile it. I have compiled it before. It's stupid to compile. I see no purpose for it. I mean, VLC is a media player. It plays my media. It does so quickly and reliably and flawlessly. I don't feel like I benefit from compiling that from source, and it's kind of a headache, to be honest. So I go to Alien Bob's UK Mirror, I grab his VLC package, and I install it that way. Other programs, I value that I can compile it from source, FFmpeg most especially, but there are some soft synths and things like that that I also enjoy in installing from source code. One is because I like the knowledge that I can look at the code. I can see what the little components are that make that program. I can look into the source directory. I can see all of these C files or C++ files and these, and I can see what is actually built after I run the make command. I can see all these shared object files. heck, if I want to, I can look at the code, I can read it, and I've done that before. I don't know how much I've understood, but I've done that, and I've even made some changes sometimes. So it's really just, it's for my own edification that I like to do this. Whether there's something to that old Gen 2 argument that, hey, if you compile it for your machine, it's better, it'll run faster, and all that other stuff, I don't know if that's true. I feel like FFmpeg, getting it compiled from source, is a really powerful thing. But more realistically, I just happen to know that there is not an FFmpeg package out there that will that is built exactly how I want it to be built. I have options that I like to turn on, turn off in FFmpeg. Usually it's turning them on, and it's really hard to find an FFmpeg that would make me happy. And yes, I've looked at Debian Multimedia and I've looked at RPM Fusion. Still like to compile it from source. Of course, making with the makeflag-j8 helps a lot, so it goes pretty quickly. And like I say, after I build it on one computer, I can distribute it over others if I choose to, or I can compile it on each machine depending on how much time and how much patience I have. So compiling source, I don't know how important or vital it is. I feel like it's vital to Linux and to free software, being able to get the code and actually take advantage of it. I feel like I am using one of the benefits that I inherit from being a Linux user by actually taking the developers up on that offer. Like, yes, I'll take your source code. Yes, I will compile it on my machine. Thank you very much. I like that freedom. I like the ability to be able to do that. I like doing that. On the other hand, I do value the fact that there are Slack packages out there. LibreOffice, I have never compiled in my life. I would never want to have to compile that. VLC, a couple of different applications out there. KDE, for instance. I wouldn't ever want to have to compile that. Well, I would, actually, for fun, but I haven't yet, and I've tried, and I've failed. But, yeah, I'm really excited that there are pre-built binaries out there for that. So these are all my thoughts, and I'm not trying to sort of argue with either K5Tux or Sig3, who were the two that I can definitely remember talked to me about this. But they are sort of the why. Like, that's why I like doing the dependency resolution myself, and that's why I like to compile software myself. And when those two things intersect, it's why I like to do both of them at once. And when they don't, it's still why I choose one or the other. So thank you very much for the comments. Sig3 actually emailed me a response to my response. I don't exactly remember, or I haven't looked at that recently, and I will probably email him back with more comments. But I don't feel like I need to read his second email because I don't believe that I'm arguing with him publicly. I'm just talking about ideas that he has given me, which is really cool. I have to say, of all the feedback that I've gotten, I think this was some of the most thought-provoking feedback, because it really made me like kind of step back from what I was doing and really think about, well, why am I doing it this way? And it also brings me to the very, I think, important question of how elite, let's say, this is Sig3's word, and when I first read it, I thought, I kind of bristled a little bit, but how elite is this, you know? And he makes a good point about the concept of elitism, and how, you know, the further a lot of us get into sort of the geekiness of what we do, we have to almost be mindful, I think. It helps to be mindful. How portable is this? Like, are we making it so esoteric and so obscure and so complex that there's just no hope for people to ever get involved in what we are doing? And that's a tough one, because it's kind of like, you know, I don't want to compromise what I'm doing if I like what I'm doing. I mean, there's no real reason to compromise. But at the same time, you don't want to check out of reality and talk to your friends and you're just like, oh, it's easy. Don't worry. You can compile code. It's super easy. Because if you actually sit down with someone and show them and they start doing it and then it fails, you know, and you're like, oh, don't worry. It's just saying that it depends on this library. You just need to go grab that. I mean, that's Greek. It's like Greek to them. They have no idea what you're saying. And so we need to be mindful of that concept of how obscure and kind of withdrawn from normal, quote-unquote normal computing we are getting, and whether or not we're aware of that, because we could be elite without really meaning to be elite. And I know that none of us actually intend to be elite. Like, most of us, I think, would cite getting into Linux because it's more accessible than other software. But at some point, when it starts taking all this kind of specialized knowledge, well, it stops becoming accessible then. It really becomes like this thing that you have to achieve. You have to get into it, because if you don't understand it, you have to spend like 3 years researching it until you finally figure out what a kernel is and how stuff is compiled and what this error message means. And it does. It takes a while to understand that. So I think that's a really good point. Still not going to give up compiling from source and from resolving my own dependencies, but he makes a darned good point about that. And it's something to keep in mind, I guess. Like, just how are we to being completely checked out of reality versus are we making allowances for the quote-unquote normal computer user? It's important. It's very important. And if you think about it, like, if you're the geek in your community and you're going to be managing people's computers, well, that's really cool. But how is that any different than Microsoft or another company doing that for people? You know, like, I don't know. This is a big topic, and I can't even fathom it yet. Yes, the code is there. That's the important difference. But if people aren't looking at it, if people don't understand it, then how is it any different than Microsoft Office? Something to think about. It's very, very puzzling. And I have not begun to touch on that topic. And like I said, I'm not going to, because I need to wrap this episode up. And I will. I will wrap this episode up. But first, very, very quickly, Frank Bell emailed. Frank is great. I know him from HPR. I think I knew him before then even. But yeah, he wants to hear more about security, Linux security. Frank, I would love to hear more about security as well, but frankly, I'm not the guy to talk about Linux security. There are people who know a lot about security who I would love to listen to and learn from. And if I did it, I just know it would be one of those episodes where you hear like some person muddling through like multimedia stuff, and you can tell that they are just kind of figuring it out, and you catch all these errors, and then you're like, I should email them, and then you end up writing a book, you know, to correct them. It's just, yeah, that would be me. I would be talking about security, and then I would get like a book thrown at me. So I'm gonna just wait for the experts to talk about security. I will, you know, keep it in mind and try to be mindful of it, but don't hold your breath. Unfortunately, you wouldn't want to hear about all that stuff from me, because I'm not an expert. Deep Geek also wrote and said that he, what did he say? Hold on, let me get to his email. He said he wanted to he wanted to mention rather CMTab, which is this program that comes along with CryptMount, and CryptMount enables encrypted partitions to become mounted. So it's basically, think of it as Etsy FSTAB, except for encrypted partitions. Sounds very cool. I've not tried it. He just mentioned it in an email. I've not looked into it at all, but it does sound kind of cool. He also declares a new game called the GWO, that's New World Order, coffee drinking game. It's a lot like other drinking games, but it involves coffee. I appreciate that, Deep Geek. Gameplay is simple. Every time Klaatu, that's me, avoids mentioning a certain OS from his past, you drink coffee. I think that's a very good idea. I think you would have already had to drink like 5 shots today already through this episode. So great idea for a drinking game. Thank you, Deep Geek. And that's this episode. Speaking of people not being just consumers and actually producing stuff, here's some outro music that was actually written by Pegwall, who you might know from like DevRandom or Linux Cranks, and he composed this entirely on LMMS on a Linux system. Enjoy. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at GNUworldOrder.info or slackermedia.info. You You can contact me via Jabber at notclatoo@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notclatoo. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.